When Aureliano finds out, he's going to shoot you, and I'll be the first one to be glad. But it was of no use. Arcadio continued tightening the tourniquet with unnecessary rigor until he became the cruelest ruler that Macondo had ever known. Now let them suffer the difference, Don Apolinar Moscote said on one occasion. This is the liberal paradise. Arcadio found out about it. At the head of a patrol, he assaulted the house, destroyed the furniture, flogged the daughters, and dragged out Don Apolinar Moscote. When Ursula burst into the courtyard of headquarters, after having gone through the town shouting shame and brandishing with rage a pitch-covered whip, Arcadio himself was preparing to give the squad the command to fire. "I dare you to, bastard!" Ursula shouted. Before Arcadio had time to react, she let go with the first blow of the lash. "I dare you to, murderer!" she shouted. "And kill me, too, son of an evil mother! That way I won't have the eyes to weep for the shame of having raised a monster!" Whipping him without mercy, she chased him to the back of the courtyard, where Arcadio curled up like a snail in its shell. Don Apolinar Moscote was unconscious, tied to the post where previously they had had the scarecrow that had been cut to pieces by shots fired in fun. The boys in the squad scattered, fearful that Ursula would go after them, too. But she did not even look at them. She left Arcadio with his uniform torn, roaring with pain and rage, and she untied Don Apolinar Moscote and took him home. Before leaving the headquarters, she released the prisoners from the stocks. From that time on, she was the one who ruled in the town. She reestablished Sunday Mass, suspended the use of red armbands, and abrogated the harebrained decrees. But in spite of her strength, she still wept over her unfortunate fate. She felt so much alone that she sought the useless company of her husband, who had been forgotten under the chestnut tree. "Look what we've come to," she would tell him as the June rains threatened to knock the shelter down. "Look at the empty house, our children scattered all over the world, and the two of us alone again, the same as in the beginning." José Arcadio Buendía, sunk in an abyss of unawareness, was deaf to her lamentations. At the beginning of his madness, he would announce his daily needs with urgent Latin phrases. In fleeting, clear spells of lucidity, when Amaranta would bring him his meals, he would tell her what bothered him most, and would accept her sucking glasses and mustard plasters in a docile way. But at the time when Ursula went to lament by his side, he had lost all contact with reality. She would bathe him bit by bit as he sat on his stool while she gave him news of the family. "Aureliano went to war more than 4 months ago, and we haven't heard anything about him," she would say, scrubbing his back with a soaped brush. "José Arcadio came back a big man, taller than you, and all covered with needlework, but he only brought shame to our house." She thought she noticed, however, that her husband would grow sad with the bad news. Then she decided to lie to him. "You won't believe what I'm going to tell you," she said as she threw ashes over his excrement in order to pick it up with the shovel. "God willed that José Arcadio and Rebecca should get married, and now they're very happy." She got to be so sincere in the deception that she ended up by consoling herself with her own lies. "Arcadio is a serious man now," she said, "and very brave, and a fine-looking young man with his uniform and saber." It was like speaking to a dead man, for José Arcadio Buendía was already beyond the reach of any worry. But she insisted. He seemed so peaceful, so indifferent to everything, that she decided to release him. He did not even move from his stool. He stayed there, exposed to the sun and the rain, as if the thongs were unnecessary, for a dominion superior to any visible bond kept him tied to the trunk of the chestnut tree. Toward August, when winter began to last forever, Ursula was finally able to give him a piece of news that sounded like the truth. "Would you believe it, that good luck is still pouring down on us?" she told him. "Amaranta and the Pianola Italian are going to get married." Amaranta and Pietro Crespi had, in fact, deepened their friendship, protected by Ursula, who this time did not think it necessary to watch over the visits. It was a twilight engagement. The Italian would arrive at dusk with a gardenia in his buttonhole, and he would translate Petrarch's sonnets for Amaranta. They would sit on the porch, suffocated by the oregano and the roses, he reading and she sewing lace cuffs, indifferent to the shocks and bad news of the war, until the mosquitoes made them take refuge in the parlor. Amaranta's sensibility, her discreet but enveloping tenderness, had been weaving an invisible web about her fiancé, which she had to push aside materially with his pale and ringless fingers in order to leave the house at 8 o'clock. They had put together a delightful album with the postcards that Pietro Crespi received from Italy. They were pictures of lovers in lonely parks, with vignettes of hearts pierced with arrows and golden ribbons held by doves.